Mr. Bard, 4 months for the garage, Kitari Aras, the parents of the Sushi Man, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhakti Vedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada, Ki, Sri Sri Panchatattva Ki, Sri Sri Rabbi Madhavas, the Saki Brinda Ki, Sri Sri Prahlad Nishrinda Ki, Sri Sri Maya Purdam Ki, Ganga Mayi Ki, Gaur Premanam Ki, all glories to the assembled world, all glories to the assembled world, all glories to Sri Guru and Gaur. All right, so today we'll move on to mantra 2 and mantra 3. So we'll chat, we'll deal with them individually. We'll do mantra 2 first and then we'll do the purport. Important points, then we'll go on. So we can all chant this together. Kurvane Vah Karmani Jiji Veshek Shadam Sama Evam Tvaina Yate Tosin Na Karma Yivite Lare.
One man aspired to live for hundreds of years. If he continues to go to the working in that way, but that sort of work will not bind him to the low karma. There is no alternative to this way for men.
So, actually, if you look at your revision sheet here, there's a few things that have been pulled out. I haven't necessarily marked them up on the text here, but the things that have been singled out on this revision sheet: oil in the machine, overindulgence in milk, and living for hundreds of years. So let's have a look and see what we've got here. Nobody wants to die. Everybody wants to live as long as he can drag on. This is because the living being is eternal by nature. But due to his bondage in material existence, he has to change his body over and over. This process is called transmigration of the soul, or karma bandha, bondage by one's work. We have to work for our livelihood. If we don't work or act according to the prescribed duties, we transgress the laws of nature. So, in other words, there's a plan. Having already stated that everything is perfect and complete, and that Ishavashyam, there is an Isha or a controller, an oversight, if you like, in all forms of life, but especially in human form of life, there's a plan. And we have to follow that plan if we want to realize the fruits that are intended for us. And if we don't follow the plan, then we get something else. The universe is perfect and complete. It's a complete unit. And there are perfect and complete activities that a living being can follow. And if he practices those activities, then he'll actually get out of this karma bandha. That's the purpose of human life. Everybody else, Prabhupada said, is firmly bound up by the laws of nature, the lower animals. They cannot do something different. Yeah, a tiger can't just sit down and decide he wants to be a vegetarian. Yeah, he has to act according to his nature. And I remember that a few years back in England, they have this place called Longleat, where they experimented and they brought some tigers and lions and other animals from Africa. And they set them up like a game reserve, but in England. Because they had to make some special arrangements for when it snowed and all that stuff. But basically, the man that did it, he had this idea that if you actually treat them as pets, then the tigers and lions will become pets. In other words, that you can domesticate these kinds of animals. So right from birth, they were having tiger cubs and they would pet them and look after them and play with them, and the tigers grew up and, they knew their keepers and everything. And they showed pictures of them going up and the tiger would stand up. I mean, tigers are huge. If you've seen a full-grown tiger, when they're fully extended, they're about 12 feet long from tip of the tail to the nose. The body's like about 2 meters, at least, more, 2.5 meters. They're huge. And it showed, the guys up there, and the tiger gets up and puts his paws on his shoulders and licks his face, like it's all very nice. And then there was a report in the newspaper that some girl who was a keeper, she'd gone in there, and then one of the tigers came up behind her and killed her. Just bit her on the back of the neck. That's how they get the prey. You see in the films, they jump on the back and they bite the neck. They break the neck. That's how they kill their prey. So the tiger just jumped up and that was it, finished. And then it showed the guy on the TV afterwards, they were interviewing him, and he was like bewildered.
Oh, I don't know how this could have happened.
Our whole philosophy now is all, jeopardized and like this. And I was thinking, well, of course, you idiot. It's a tiger, what do you expect? You can't change the nature. It's a wild animal, it's built for killing. That's what it does, that's its instinct. So there's no changing that. That's karma bandha. You are bound up by your acquired nature, at least in the lower species. But in the human form, you can break that bondage. You can actually discover your eternal nature, and you can give up your acquired nature. It's not easy to do. The force of the body and mind and intellect is very strong, the attachment that we have for it. But if it's handled very carefully, then actually you can realize your higher nature, your spiritual nature, and you can shed your acquired nature. So this is the whole purpose. This is the purpose of the universe. This is the plan. We're not supposed to be here imitating Krishna, trying to be possessors, controllers, and enjoyers. So Ishvashya means recognizing the proprietorship of the Lord, and that means his proprietorship, as Prabhupada said, of our bodies, our minds, our intellects, and our very souls. We are part and parcel of the Supreme Lord. And then that means that if we understand that, that God exists. I remember when I made the decision to become a devotee, I had a very striking realization. I finally understood that God actually exists. And then the next thing immediately that came out unexpectedly was that realizing that God existed and that he was everything, omniscient, all-powerful, omnipresent, then I realized, well, hey, now what does that mean? What's the consequence of understanding that God exists? That means that there's nothing I can do that he doesn't know about. There's nothing I can do that's out of his control. So what can I do? Now, if I'm going to be honest, I have to surrender. I actually have to accept that he is everything, and he owns everything, including me. That means I have no choice now except to find out what he wants. So I joined a temple. I'd never been to a temple before that. I've got some magazines, but I got that realization. I made up my mind. I have to go and join these people. I had no idea what they did, but I knew this is the principle and I had to follow it. So if we actually understand that God exists, it's implicit in that understanding that then we have to do what he wants us to do, and we have to find out what those prescribed duties are. And it's not onerous. That's the point. Just like Bhaktaram Jagannathapa Samsavalokam Maheshwaram Suridam Sarvabhutanam. That's the key factor in that. You might recognize that there's a superior force who controls everything and who has, the right to enjoy everything as a result of that possession and control. But you could still be envious. The demons are like that. Just like Hiranyakashipu, he knew Vishnu was around somewhere. And he was envious, even though, you know, he was informed there is this personality Vishnu, but he was envious. Why should he enjoy everything? And he thought, he's an enemy. Why? Because his own lusty desires were so strong. So despite knowing or hearing about the power of the Supreme Lord, but his envy couldn't let him accept that. And so he had to challenge it. Of course, he got finished. But the point is that the next step, when we recognize the supremacy of the Supreme Lord, not the Supreme Person, is to also realize that he's Suridham. He's our best friend. And so whatever he prescribes for us is actually for our self-interest. That's our real interest. Not that now we have been made subordinate and we have to work like slaves, yeah, or robots or something. No. It's the whole principle of it is to realize the friendship of the Lord. Accept his beneficence and accept his arrangement as being our self-interest. And that's the whole point. So if we do that, then karma bandhana, that bondage of work, that is automatically released from that. We're not under the control of the modes of material nature anymore, that Durga, Prakriti, but rather we come under the control of the spiritual energy, which is Radharani, who is blessing us. Durga's business is to capture us and keep us down. But Radharani's business is to bring us up, to bless us, and to bring us into the association of Krishna. So those two Prakritis are at work. So if he does not act according to prescribed duties, he transgresses the laws of nature. So they're our laws, we have to follow them. If we don't follow them, we get punished. So karma, a karma, and v karma are very clearly described in Bhagavad Gita. Prescribed duties, as mentioned in revealed scripture, that is karma. We use karma as a catch-all phrase sometimes, but actually in the Gita it's specific. It means authorized activity, prescribed activity. Actions that free one from the cycle of birth and death, a karma. That means doing everything for Krishna. And actions that are performed through the misuse of one's freedom, that direct one to the lower forms of life, that is vikarma. So most people are engaged in vikarma because they actually don't know what the laws of nature are. They want freedom, but they actually don't know what real freedom is. They think freedom to act like an animal. That is freedom. Yeah? The animals are not hung up. They have no guilty conscience. Why should we? Let's do anything that we like. And there should be no rule and regulation. We should just do your own thing. Yeah? Just like John Lennon. He was a great proponent of do your own thing. And so somebody else did their own thing on him. And the end result is that he was killed. So there's no such thing as do your own thing. And freedom, there's no such thing as freedom in the sense of complete independence to do whatever you like. It's a myth. Yeah? Real freedom is to actually follow the law. And when you follow the law, you don't go into jail. If you don't follow the law, you actually have to follow the law. But if you want to try to not follow the law, the end result is you go to jail. And then you're under more restriction. Yeah? Because you abuse your privileged position. So in the same way, in the human life, we have that opportunity now to get released from material nature. But it doesn't mean that now we become fully independent. We're still dependent. You're always dependent in every circumstance. But you have to find out which dependence gives you happiness. And that is, of course, spiritual dependence. Material dependence means then your so-called freedoms, you're under an illusion then. And because you're in illusion, you'll never be happy. Because whatever you realize by the endeavor that's performed in illusion, the end result of it will also be an illusion. So if you think you're getting some happiness, yeah, some fruit from your endeavor, but your endeavor is based on an illusory concept, then what's the end result going to be? That's also going to be an illusion. Therefore, just when we think we're becoming happy, it all evaporates. Everybody's always running, chasing after that, you know, mirage in the desert, happiness. And they never get it. But devotional life actually brings us to real happiness. So such liberating work is described here in the pages of the Ishupanishad. So, Gita Upanishad is the cream of all the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita. So in other words, this is a synopsis in one sense of what's in the Bhagavad Gita, the Ishupanishad, and other Upanishads. Bhagavad Gita 3:9-16, you can read those verses if you like it in your spare time. Personality of Godhead says, one cannot attain the state of nice karma or akarma without executing prescribed duties mentioned in Vedic literature. This literature can regulate the working energy of a human being in such a way he can gradually realize the authority of the Supreme Being. So these are the law books. There are the laws, and Vedic literature describes what the laws are. Prabhupada once gave an example to a reporter in London, Mike Robinson. He was from the LBC, London Broadcasting Company. I had a great interview with Prabhupada. He was just a young guy at that time. Now he's some big executive with the same company. But during that conversation, Prabhupada was quoting, you know, different verses. So then he was curious. He asked, and now you're saying these verses to me. What are those? Then Prabhupada explained, these are from the Veda. This is our scripture. And so he asked, what is the purpose of that? And then Prabhupada explained, just like we have this microphone. So when the microphone is produced, the manufacturer provides a book to explain how to use it and how to fix it if it goes wrong or like that. So he said, similarly, when the universe is created, there's a book that comes out with it, an operational manual. That's the Vedas. It explains how it's constructed, what its utility is, and how you can get the best advantage from it. So that's the Vedas. It's the operational manual for the creation that is this material universe. So, this literature can regulate the working energy of a human being. It's working. Everybody has to be active. So, how to get the best advantage from your activity. Nobody can not do something. Factually, no one has to do anything more than render devotional service to the Lord. However, in the lower stages of life, one cannot immediately adopt the activities of devotional service, nor can one completely stop fruitive work. So in other words, you can't immediately realize your transcendental nature. Theoretically, you can do. You can understand I'm not this body. But that's actually a long way from actually, you know, not being your body, realizing that you're not the body. Theoretically, it's the one thing, yeah. But vidya takes some time. Therefore, there has to be some prescribed duties, because you can't immediately stop, you know, this tendencies to work for this acquired nature's benefit, this body, benefit of the body and the mind. We're so addicted to that, it's very difficult to separate ourselves from that mentality. And therefore, Prabhupada points out that because of this fruitive mentality, selfish interest, we get so many isms. Yeah, socialism, altruism, communism, nationalism, humanitarianism. These isms are certainly very attractive forms of calm abandon. Yeah, everybody thinks, no, this is very liberating to be very altruistic, to be a great humanitarian. No, it's just another form of bondage, that's all. Yeah.
What's your question? Do you have to wait
until
the end?
No, no, ask your one.
Okay, so.
Yeah.
It's regarding the previous chapter, one, whatever. The quote from Bhagavad Gita is, it's on the level of the Nishkarma, or karma, without executing the prescribed duties mentioned in the Vedic literature.
Yes.
Most of us in the Western hemisphere, we've born without Vedic literature.
Yeah.
So our duties are not really known to us. So what's the best way to hit the duties?
Well, Prabhupada explains that in every section of human society, there is some regulation, there is some regulating authority, there's some religious authority. So even if we don't have the Vedic authority, let's say we're in Australia or America or South America or wherever it is, but there's always been some kind of religious authority. And that religious authority is based on a recognition of the existence of God and man's subordination to him. So you may not have a lot of details about who God is and, you know, all the finer instructions. It may not be set out, you know, as clearly, but still there's some regulation there. And then Prabhupada said that you get benefit from following that. So Krishna, in different societies, you know, different cultures, still makes his presence known in one way or in another. And there are shastras in different parts of the world. But when you actually come to, you know, be really serious about understanding who God is and, you know, really making the attempt to get out of this material world, then ultimately you come to the Veda. And therefore Prabhupada said that a birth in India, any birth in India, is better than any birth in the West. He actually said that. And Paramahansa and Shrudakirti were with him, and I think it was in Hawaii, and they were shocked. They said, any birth, Prabhupada? Even a rickshaw wallet? Prabhupada said, yes, even a rickshaw wallet. Why? Because automatically, from the day they're born, practically, they hear the name of Krishna. So they're hearing the holy names. And there's the culture is there. So there's some contact, there's some awareness. Yeah. Because things are changing a little now. But we talked about that yesterday, about therefore why ISKCON is so important. That the appearance of ISKCON is so important at this time in India's history. What to speak about giving this knowledge to the West and making people in the West aware, you know, of these higher principles. So it's, you know, Krishna does make an arrangement. There's always something there. And if there's no arrangement, then it's to be understood that that form of life or section of human society is very condemned. Yeah. Very condemned. Some sections are actually going down. And most are coming up, but some are going back down by stages. Yeah. This is Asura Yoni, that species that the Asuras take birth in, the bodies that they get, that due to his enmity, this is Bhagavad Gita, due to his enmity against God, then gradually he goes down into lower and lower forms, and then eventually becomes an animal. And then automatically, again by Krishna's arrangement, he comes back up. So Krishna's always making some arrangement, but depending on the receptivity, then we get a birth, you know, in one section of human society or in another. And then, you know, we get more or less instruction.
The reason I'm asking is because I see so many people confused about what to do. Like, even materially, they don't know. They go to college, universities, and you ask them, when I do books, I ask them, so what are you going to do? They you know, they're just speaking like they go into a land in space in their mind, but it's so vague. It's very sad because they're going to give 3-4 years of their life, they're gonna be in debt for $20,000, and after this they come out, they won't even use it. It's a very confusing system.
Yeah, therefore Prabhupada condemned the educational system. He said they actually, I have a quote at the end of this. I'll give it now because we may not get to it, but since you brought it up, let me just see if I can find it.
Let's get to it.
There. The modern civilization, most harmful civilization, denying the facility one has got the capacity to become a Brahmana, and they are denying the facility to keep him to remain like hogs and dogs. Therefore, Prabhupada's condemning the so-called educationists. We have the capacity, actually, to come to the Brahmanical platform, but we've been being denied it. That means some rectification has to be done. And that's why Lord Chaitanya appears, that's why Krishna appears. Whenever there is a degradation of religious principles, then Krishna appears at that time to re-establish the principles of religion. And therefore Prabhupada said that's the appearance of Lord Chaitanya, that we're living in a time which has now become very degraded. And therefore Krishna has appeared in the form of his name, and he's going all over the world to try to re-establish the principles of religion. So it's to be expected from the predictions that this Krishna consciousness movement will spread. It will increase in its position and prestige and influence and power. And as it increases, then it's to be expected that the demonic elements will become more agitated, and then they'll have to be dealt with. So we're at the beginning, but this is a challenge. We are challenging the very basis of modern civilization. So if you make a challenge, then what's the end result? There's going to be a fight. That's all. So if we can convince them, Prabhupada said that's very good. But if they can't be convinced, then there are other means. Somebody once asked if there's a place for atheists in Vedic culture, Vedic civilization. Prabhupada said, yes, they can live in the jungle. Alright, so any other questions up to this point? Yes, please.
Can you say that in this verse, second one, it is spoken about Nishkala Karma Yoga?
Sorry, no, I know.
It is spoken about Nishkala Karma Yoga.
Yeah.
To do your duty, knowing that actually everything belongs to Lord.
Yes, we're just coming on to that. Prabhupada explains. Where are we? The isms here. He mentions that if we're too attached, for the less intelligent that can't immediately surrender everything to God, he's got these isms. So what does he do? The Vedic instruction of Sri Shapanishad is that if one actually wants to live for any of the above isms, he should make them God-centered. There's no harm in becoming a family man, or an altruist, a socialist, a communist, a nationalist, or a humanitarian, provided that one executes his activities in relation to Ishavasya, the God-centered conception. This is the principle of dovetailing. That you can't immediately just become a pure devotee. So from theory to practice, there has to be some steps. That's sadhana bhakti. You can't automatically experience spontaneous love of Godhead. So there has to be some way of coming from the conditioned state to the liberated state. And that's the process that we're given of sadhana bhakti. And as Prabhupada says here, this is the principle. Ishavasya means do your regulated your activities, whatever your propensity is, but do it for God. Or center it. Hare Krishna. Center it around God somehow or another. Then it becomes purified. So then there's no harm, as he says, in any of these things, being a communist, a socialist, a nationalist. These are all anathema in one sense to the principles of pure devotional service. But if you can dovetail them around this Ishavasya concept, then it all becomes purified. So the greatest danger of life is the danger of gliding down again into the evolutionary cycle of birth and death amongst the 8,400,000 species. So this is something Prabhupada always emphasized. You have this unique opportunity as a human being. Don't waste it. Otherwise you go down, then it'll be millions of years maybe before you come back up. One example of that was when we were in Hawaii in 1976. We spent the whole month of May there, and Prabhupada was taking his morning walks around Magic Island, which is like a promontory on the seafront there. And there's some spot just there where some waves come in and all the surfers go. So giving the surfers as an example in his class, Prabhupada explained how the soul becomes contaminated by contact with different mixes of the modes of material nature. Combining the words surfer and sufferer, he made everybody laugh with an excellent and piercing pun. This morning, we were talking about the sufferers. What is that? The sea surfer, sufferers? Surfers. Yes. I call sea sufferers. Surfers. Yes, contamination. So that in the next life, he'll become a fish. He'll be very free to dance in the ocean. He said that they would indeed get such a birth and then spend millions of lifetimes coming once again to the human form. This perhaps struck home to some of his audience, since a few young men in the audience had longish hair and were of the beach-going type. I saw a few of them kind of... They knew Prabhupada meant it. You want to go surfing? All right. Then you become absorbed in that activity. You take birth as a fish, because that's a better body. Later on, he gave another example. Just like an elephant, very powerful beast, but when he gets in the waves, he flounders. But a small fish, the biggest wave, whoop, anywhere he can go, no problem, because that's his environment. So if you like that environment, then you get a body that's suited to it. A human body is not meant for surfing. That is not a prescribed human activity. You know, going out and paddling on a surfboard and floating on the waves. So if you die thinking of that, if that's your, you know, some people, they become obsessed with it. Then what happens? You become a fish, and then millions of years before you get back to a human form again. So it's a great tragedy. I'll give a practical example that we had a boy that joined Balaram Das, and he had a friend. His name was Bobby Brown. He was one of the more leading surfers in Australia. So the surfing culture, they go out surfing and then they go out boozing and sex and all drugs like this. So they were out. This fellow, he went out in a pub, got in a fight, and somebody broke a bottle and stuck it in his throat and killed him. Yeah? So he was dead, finished. And then later on, Balaram told me he was just starting, him and his friends, they were starting to take some interest in so-called spiritual things. So they got this Ouija board. You know what a Ouija board is? Yeah, everybody know what that is?
Yeah.
A Ouija board, it's got all the letters of the alphabet. And you get a glass. And then, I don't know, you do some incantation or something. And then you get some spirit that's supposed to come. And then you ask questions. And then the spirit moves the glass, yeah, from one letter to another and spells out the answer. Yeah, some people think it's just... You know, hocus pocus. But anyway, they got the Ouija board and they were doing it, and it was actually moving. So then at one point they asked, what happened to Bobby Brown? And so the glass began to move. F I S H. Yeah? Fish. And they all went, fish! Wow, he made it! They're all surfers, right? Now we're thinking, oh, this is bliss, yeah? To take birth as a fish and then you can permanently surf until the next big fish eats you. But that's but this is the mentality people get into. They waste their human forms of life. They have nothing to better to do with their human intelligence. Misdirected civilization, therefore Prabhupada's lamenting that, you know, these are the results. And when Prabhupada said that, you know, he said, then they'll become a fish. and one or two of them, you know, kind of they got. And then Prabhupada saw that and he said, yes, he said, somebody has become a fish. Yeah, don't think that this is just some talk. Somebody has become a fish. So why not you? It's possible. So if somehow or another a man misses the spiritual opportunity afforded by his human form of life and falls down again into the evolutionary cycle, he must be considered most unfortunate. Due to his defective senses, a foolish man cannot see that this is happening. This is the problem. They don't believe in the afterlife. They don't believe that there's a future. Whatever we have now, that's all there is. Most unfortunate. So a humble, God-centered life is more valuable than a colossal hopes of a life dedicated to godless altruism or socialism. Which reminded me, just like Bill Gates, he set up the Gates Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates. He's been glorified all over the world. Why? Because he's put $29 billion into this charitable fund. And they give out, you know, $500 million for malaria cure, you know, $50 million for this, $100 million for that, blah, blah, blah. He gives out heaps and heaps of money. They say he's the biggest altruist or giver in the history of human society, because they don't know about the Vedic kings, but at least in modern society. But I read an interview in Time magazine about Bill Gates, and they asked him, they said, you know, he's got like an amazing brain. This was like when he was in his mid-30s. And he had first written the code for the disk operating system for IBM when he was about 18. Yeah, he wrote the whole operating system. That was how they started up Microsoft. So at 35 or 38, he could still remember the first three or four sheets, every line, every bit of code that he had written, he could still remember it all. So this is the kind of brain this guy's got. And so then at one point the interviewer asked him, he said, and what about God? And then he says, oh, I don't know anything about that. That was his response. I don't know anything about that. And then he changed the subject. So a big, big man, big altruist, you know, wealthiest man in the world, very pious. You know, how did he get that birth? How did he get that kind of brain? But God, no, nothing. So what's the use? All of his activities, you know, you can set up so many medical institutions and give so much money. Are you going to cure any diseases? Does it mean nobody's going to die of disease anymore? Even a simple thought that, well, what's the end result of all of this? That we, you know, let's cure one disease, but there's so many other diseases. Can we just by spending money stop all disease so that nobody has to die? Is it possible? Then what's the use? But they don't want to look at that. No, we have to just do some good. But what good is, they actually don't know. So Prabhupada said, our institution, he was asked once, do we have a... are we going to have some kind of medical facility at Hare Krishna land in Juhu? Some man had come forward and requested, I'll do a free clinic. You give me some room. So they wanted to know, can we allocate a room in the building for this free clinic? Prabhupada said, no. Mm-hmm. He said, there are so many institutions, medical institutions, for curing people's material diseases. He says, does it mean that when they, you know, cure the disease even, that the person's not going to die? He said, but our institution means this, no more death. We are curing that disease, no more death, when you become Krishna conscious. That's the specific benefit. So, now, Prabhupada does say there that when altruistic activity is executed in the spirit of Ishapanishad, they become a form of karma yoga. That means that they're dovetailed. Then there's some benefit from that. So how one can execute God-centered activities is elaborately explained Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu by Srila Rupa Goswami. We have rendered this book into English as The Nectar of Devotion. We recommend this valuable book to all who are interested in performing their activities in the spirit of the Ishapanishad. So again, that's Prabhupada's emphasizing the Ishapanishad is really, it's a synopsis, a little look at what is later on unpacked further in Bhagavad Gita and then Srimad Bhagavatam and then of course all the corollary literatures that have been written by personalities like Rupa Goswami, Jiva Goswami, Sanatana Goswami, etc. They're all elaborations on these points. So there's a lot in these mantras. You take one of these mantras, but then the whole philosophy unfolds as you get more and more deeply into that. Yes, Prabhu.
You just enlightened about this clinics and our activities. How would you comment or in which light we should see this Bhaktivedanta Hospital, which many say it's one of the most successful preaching fields in our movement?
Well, that's a good example, the Bhaktivedanta Hospital in Mirror Road. Anybody here been there? A few. If you go there, all the doctors are devotees. Everybody's wearing tilak. You walk into the entranceway, they have Prabhupada's murti right in the middle, and they keep him very nicely, and they do puja every day. In the evenings, they have Jagannath, Baladev, and Subhadra on a moving altar, and they go from one room to the other, all around the hospital. They bring the deities into the room, and the patients all get a darshan of Lord Jagannath. They invite them to offer some flowers, and then they give them some prasadam. And if you switch on the musical system, there's one channel that plays Prabhupada lectures all day long. And there's another channel that's just music, devotional music. So they do their best to spiritualize the atmosphere, and it actually makes a big difference. When you go in, you know, you deal with the staff. All the staff are like devotees. There's so much more sense of caring, you know, looking after you. It's very much more personal than any hospital I've ever been into. And, you know, the spiritual component is very powerful there. You feel it immediately. Everybody, even the Muslims that go there, you know, they accept the prasadam and everything. They have this program, they go around, they give everybody some prasadam every morning. And even the Muslim patients, they accept it. And they ask for it. If they miss it, they ask for it. So that's one good example of that principle that Prabhupada's saying there of dovetailing. That all of these activities, altruism, humanitarianism or whatever, but when you center them on God, on Krishna, then actually, you know, it's spiritual. It's it becomes karma, nice karma, yoga. But if it's separate from Krishna, there's no element of God in there, then it's just some other mundane, ordinary mundane thing. There'll be no benefit ultimately for anybody. Yeah. You can remember there's millions of hospitals all around the world, but everybody's dying. Yeah. They're not saving anybody. And when you die, you have to take another birth. But in our hospital, if you die, they make the arrangement so that this will be the last time. Yeah. They have the devotees come in, they chant, they do give the garlands, and tulsi leaf, everything, Ganga Jal. So they try to make sure that this soul, all right, now is on his way, letting go back to home, back to Godhead. So that's actually a good example of this principle Prabhupada's talking about. Any other questions up to this point? Okay, let's go on with the next mantra, mantra 3. We can chant this. Asruyana mate loka andena tamasa vrita tamaste vrita vigashanti yeke sadma anojana. This is a good verse, this one. Quite popular with preaching. You want to read out the
The killer of the soul, whoever he may be, must enter into the planets known as the world of the faithless, full of darkness and ignorance.
Yes. So that used to be a puzzle. I remember it was a puzzle for me when I first joined. How can you kill the soul? Yeah. The soul is eternal. That was the principle that we just learned. You know, when you join, that's the first thing you understand, that we don't die, you can't kill anything, and we're eternal. And then you read the Ishapanishad and it says the killer of the soul. Saying, well, how is that? That sounds contradictory. But of course Prabhupada explains what that actually means. So here he says that throughout the universe there are only two types of human beings, the Sura and the Asura. And we mentioned this the other day in terms of, you know, the scientific explanation of the universe. So you have the mechanical explanation, or you have the theological explanation. But there are no others. Yeah, there's only two ways. You either accept God or you don't accept God. But there are no third explanations for the creation of the universe. So it's always a battle between the godly and the godless. Yeah, and that's going on. Yeah, in every sphere, there's always this division. So, intelligent human beings must always remember that the soul obtains a human form after an evolution of many millions of years in the cycle of transmigration. Very interesting that Prabhupada says, he uses the word very deliberately there, after an evolution of many millions of years. And Prabhupada said that Darwin actually got his original ideas from the Veda about evolution. But he just tried to describe it in material terms. Whereas the real evolution is the evolution of the soul coming up through different species. The species are fixed, but the soul is evolving and gradually gaining or increasing in consciousness as it comes up through the different species. So that's the evolution. It's an evolution of consciousness rather than an evolution of body. The bodies are complete. They appear at the very beginning of the universe as they are complete. But the souls, they have then different situations, and depending on where they are, they can come up automatically through the lower species. Or if they start off at the top, then they're given a choice, they could go down again. So there's evolution and devolution. That business is going on, but it's spiritual. The material world is sometimes compared to an ocean, and the human body is compared to a solid boat designed to cross this ocean. Vedic scriptures and the acharyas or saintly teachers are compared to expert boatmen, and the facilities of the human body are compared to favorable breezes that help the boat ply smoothly to its desired destination. If with all these facilities a human being does not fully utilize his life for self-realization, he must be considered Atmaha, a killer of the soul, denying one's own existence, the viability of one's own existence. And we'll talk a bit more about this when we get to the end of this purport, but this is the position that material science has put us in. I've mentioned this several times, that they actually deny the viability of their lives, their own lives. They're living beings, but they say, no, we're not living beings. Life has no value, only matter has value. Life just comes and goes. It lasts for a few years and then evaporates and disappears. It didn't come from anywhere and it's not going anywhere. Therefore, it has no value. And yet they themselves are living beings that are making that statement. If you think about that, why should they bother making a statement? If their lives themselves have no value, then your statements have no value either. So why bother talking? Why bother having big institutions spending billions of dollars all around the world on scientific investigation when you've already declared that life has no value? The only thing that has value is chemicals. And even that, they say, it expands and contracts, it comes and goes. In other words, nothing has any value whatsoever. They're killers of the soul. These are the real killers of the soul, in complete denial of their own existence. Because that principle of denial is known in psychology. When a person refuses to recognize what's really happening. Yeah. Something adverse happens to him, or his philosophy is, you know, found to be faulty, but he can't admit it. False ego. He goes into denial. Or something horrible happens, somebody dies or whatever, and they can't accept it. So they go into denial. No, no, it didn't happen. Like this. So how long can you remain in denial? And as long as you're in denial, you can't understand anything. Because you've blocked everything off. You're not open, you're not learning, you're not progressive. You're in denial. No, no. And that's exactly what the situation is with modern scientists. They're in denial of the soul. They refuse to accept it, so there's no chance for them to actually become educated and really learn anything. They box themselves in. Yeah? And it becomes absurd. The whole thing becomes an absurdity. And sometimes they'll tell you that, and that you'll see different Western philosophers, they come to that conclusion, because they don't know about the eternal nature of the soul, and they don't know about the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They deny that. So like Nietzsche or others, they come to the conclusion that life is simply absurd. Absurd means it has no value, no meaning, no purpose, no benefit. And then you may as well just kill yourself. And some of them do that. That's what Nietzsche, that's what he did. One of those guys, so-called big philosopher.
Yeah,
who was it?
Sartre.
One of those, Sartre maybe? Yeah. A
couple of them.
Nietzsche went crazy.
Yeah, Nietzsche went crazy. And Sartre? Sartre?
I think so.
Yeah, I think he killed himself.
Somebody. There's a funny story about one wall. Somebody painted the sentence of Nietzsche. God is dead, signed Nietzsche. And the next day there was another sentence. Nietzsche is dead, signed God.
Yeah, I remember that one.
Somebody was bringing a point to me, which is it's a different way of seeing it. But if God is absolute, then if you want, he can zap the soul.
If he wants, he can
zap. He can make it disappear.
Yes, he does that. He merges you into the grand effulgence.
That's the zapping.
That's it. Lose your identity.
Yeah. So is it because he's displeased with the living entity that he would do such a thing?
No, it's because they're displeased with him. They don't want to recognize Krishna, the personality, and surrender to him. Prabhupada said that is the last snare of Maya. Yeah? You're in the material world trying to imitate Krishna by possessing, controlling, and enjoying. And then when you're a failure at that, you have to give it up and you have to admit, actually, I'm not supreme. Yeah, at least in that sense. So then they go the other way. And then they adopt this philosophy, Mayavada philosophy, that everything, again, the same thing. Everything is absurd. Everything is an illusion. And that we get free from this illusion, and then we just merge into this all-pervasive, unknown, formless, identity-less something, and then we all become God. Yeah. So that's the last snare. You can't be God by yourself, so you make everybody else God, and we all become God together, and we merge like that.
What I don't like about
that is God's last trick on you.
There's something I don't like about it. Is that I always think that Brahmajyoti is so big. I mean, there's so many living entities who are just like that. It's kind of very disgusting, isn't it?
Not really, because the spiritual world is expanding. Ever expanding. There's no limits to it. So you can't say that the Brahma majority is bigger than the Vaikuntha planets when the Vaikuntha planets themselves are unlimited. So it's Prabhupada, you know, he used to warn us about trying to quantify everything. This is our problem. You know, that's why it's a tutor. It's inconceivable. You can't capture the spiritual world in your mind. It's there, but it has no limitations. There's no dimensions to it. So just like, you know, the description of the material world being 1/4 of the total creation, that implies that there's a boundary, you know, to the total creation, and here's a quarter of it. But there's not. That's just to give us the understanding that it's subordinate and inferior and less than the spiritual realm. That the spiritual realm, Goloka Vrindavan itself, is bigger than all of the rest of the Vaikuntha Lokas put together. And yet all of those are unlimited. And Goloka Vrindavan is unlimited, and all of that is produced from Krishna. And he lives on Goloka Vrindavan, but it's produced from him. You can't conceive it. It's not possible. So don't worry about whether there's more living beings in the Brahman than there is on the Goloka Vrindavan planet or the Vaikuntha Loka planets.
And well, I was just appreciating how Prabhupada is nirvishesha nirvadi, you know, like he's really preaching against it.
Yeah, well, they are the killers of the soul also. They're in denial of the individual existence of the spirit soul and the individual existence of the Supreme Lord. So they're also another edition of Atmaha. They don't want to recognize, you know, life. That's what they want to eliminate. It's spiritual suicide. So therefore, Prabhupada says that the people are suicidal, actually. Modern civilization is suicidal. But the Mayavadis are also suicidal. And in his Pranam mantra, he recognized that the disease of impersonalism is everywhere. You know, we used to think, at least I did when I first joined, and many devotees did, we'd never been to India before, we had no idea of anything at all. But we'd read about the Mayavadis, and we'd think, who are these Mayavadis? Some kind of sect or, you know, another cult in India or something. But actually they're not. The Mayavadis, there's a Mayavadi in you. After a while I realized that Prabhupada's talking about us all. You know, we have that tendency to be impersonalists, to be Mayavadis. And by devotional service then we come out of that. So Prabhupada's business was to destroy Nirvishesha Shunyavada, this kind of nihilistic approach, Atmaha, to change us from Atmaha, you know, into enlivened living beings. So that, you know, impersonalists are everywhere. And you can see the material scientists, they're the biggest Mayavadis of all. Very difficult to convince them. Yes, Bruno.
What can we say if you are preaching to some atheists? Then they try to compare us to other religions, and they say like, "But you say like every religion says that you are the best, and your religion is on the top." And so, how can we?
How can we explain that Krishna consciousness is not just another addition of another religion? And the answer is that, you know, Prabhupada gave the examples that gold is gold, education is education. We're an educational movement. We're dealing with, you know, truths. We're not concerned with dogmas, but we're concerned with the truth. We're concerned with finding out who God actually is, what our relationship actually is. And that's for everybody, every living being. We don't exclude, you know, just like so many different religions, they exclude others. You know, or they say, my God, not your God. But we don't talk about that. And, you know, the Ishapanishad doesn't talk about the Hindu God or even the Vedic God. It just talks about the Supreme Lord, you know, the absolute truth. Jama, Jasya, Jata, like that. The absolute truth is that from which everything emanates. He is the knower of everything, indirectly and directly. These are definitions of the Supreme Lord. There's no sectarianism there. Anybody can accept that. If they're open, they can accept these explanations. And that's what we did. We understood this goes beyond, you know, dogma and so-called mundane religion. It's just dealing with the search for truth. It's providing answers to the questions that every human being should be asking. So if you know the philosophy, you should be able to explain it in such a way that people appreciate, yes, this is actually, this is knowledge. Yeah, this is not just some concoction coming from some particular group of people. That's why we try to avoid being designated as Hindus. Because immediately then it creates in people's minds this idea that, oh, this is just some religion. And they've got their own ideas, they've got their own gods, you know. They've got their own moral standards or whatever it is. And that's their thing. And we have to... Prabhupada was always trying to get away from that and explain, this is not a religion, this is an educational movement. It's meant for the enlightenment of every living being. And we have the backing up to, you know, to show that. Any other questions? Yes, Bruno.
I think that this is also very relevant, as we were discussing the first day about, you know, women in less intelligent. So this is also something which is floating around our movement, that, you know, some devotees think, you know, even if somebody wants to speak strongly and openly, and as you say, as Prabhupada was doing, challenging the scientists, you know, then you will have, you know, a bunch of devotees behind you telling that, you know, who are you to speak like this, you should not speak like this, and, you know, don't, you know, don't disturb them or something like that. You know. So how to deal with such, in such a position?
Yes.
I think that this was also his question.
You have to just go right ahead. Yeah. Not everybody will understand. When Prabhupada started preaching in the Western countries, he was criticized by practically 100% of his god brothers. But he didn't, you know, didn't deter him. He knew what he was going to say. He, you know, he knew what his spiritual master wanted him to do, and he went ahead and did that. So we can't, you know, there's always going to be, you know, the naysayers, people who don't like what you're doing, who criticize it, or become disturbed because you're out there preaching and disturbing other people, you know, causing, you know, some kind of a ruckus in human society. No, 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 we're not like that. Hinduism means, you know, we're friends with everybody, right? We're the peaceful, you know, religion. We allow anything and everything. Yeah, that's their idea. So we accept everything. But that's actually not Vedic religion. Vedic religion is very clear. Sanatan Dharma. Yeah, it's very clear what it is. And some people will criticize you, even so-called devotees, if you go out and preach. They just want some so-called peaceful existence. But Prabhupada said that's not the business of Krishna's appearance. Right from the time Krishna made his appearance, he was fighting with the demons. Right from the very moment that he made his appearance, he was fighting with the demons. He said, this movement is made to fight. We want to fight with the demons. We want to go out, we want to challenge them. That was Prabhupada. He was very energetic in preaching, and he didn't care whether people appreciated it or not. I was mentioning yesterday, just like Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, he also... He was a very heavy preacher, so much so that many of his disciples they didn't like to bring newcomers before him because he was so heavy. Yeah. They were embarrassed. And therefore those people that were embarrassed like them, Prabhupada said, but they all fell away. Those that didn't have that faith in Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, they all fell away. Those that criticized him, they all left. So we have to, you know, have some conviction about what we're doing. Preaching work means, you know, coming up against opposing elements. If there's no opposition, there's nobody to preach to, that's Vaikuntha. Yeah, you're already in the spiritual world. So material world means there's going to be conflict. But for the right cause, then that's good, it's beneficial. Arjuna wasn't advised to go off and, you know, be a nice guy. Yeah, he had to get really angry. If you want to kill somebody, you have to be furious. Yeah, if you want to actually get involved in a battle, you have to be so furious that you can kill somebody. Now, he was doing that. He had to go out and wipe out so many friends, brothers, relatives, well-wishers, teachers, everything, everybody he respected. But Krishna stirred him up to the point where he went out to kill them. So that kind of conviction you have to have. So there may be others that don't appreciate that. That's all right, let them stay on the farm, so in their home. So. But this is a preaching movement. Yeah? We're meant to cause controversy. Its very purpose is to be controversial. Yes, ma'am.
Controversial question to this. We see sometimes we act, or preacher act, out of false ego, and you know, he's not sensitive, and you know, he just, like Christians, you know, some Christians or Muslim fanatics, they just push their line, and how we can avoid become like this, you know, just become, you know, preaching out of false ego, because we get there, we want everybody else to be like we are, just to feel confident. So this is very often seen in such a preaching also. I mean, when you preach out of compassion, it was seen, preaching out of false ego, so...
Yeah, we're not preaching dogma, that's the point. It's not some concoction. We're presenting the absolute truth according to the Veda. That means that we don't deviate from that, whether people accept it or not. It doesn't mean that, you know, we're going to hammer people and force them to accept something unreasonable. You know, that's not the system. Prabhupada said, if you go out preaching and, you know, you make, if like say if you're going out selling books, and it, but if you make a person angry and they go away, then that's your failure. You have to be so expert in presenting the philosophy that people accept, yes, this is actually reasonable. There'll be some demons, they'll never accept anything, and they may cause obstacles. That's another thing. Then for those people, you know, the preacher is advised to work around them. But sometimes there may be some direct confrontation that you can't avoid. Like the Pandavas. They did everything possible to avoid fighting. Everything possible, even to the point when Krishna himself personally went to try to make peace. And when there was absolutely no hope that they could have any peace with this man, Duryodhana, then they went to war. So we don't do that whimsically. Yeah. We use logic, we use, you know, reasonable argument and persuasion. That's the point. But we don't deviate from that. We're not going... You know, people challenge us. We're not afraid of being challenged. You know, if you speak the truth, then, you know, it's bound to cause controversy. There's nothing so controversial as the truth.
For a liar. Yeah,
for most people, that's the last thing that they want to hear. Yeah? The truth hurts. People would rather be an illusion. And when you try to wake them up, you know, then I had a friend actually when I was about 18. And he used to like sleeping. And if you go and wake him up, he would become so angry that you disturbed him in his sleep. He would just lash out and kick and punch and, you know, everything. Even his mother. Yeah, because he wanted to sleep. Then you would just have to leave him until he woke up. You couldn't do anything. So people are like that, you know, they like to be an illusion. They don't like to hear the truth. The truth hurts. So if you're a, you know, if you're preaching something beneficial for people, you would think, yeah, they welcome you with open arms, but they don't, because they're an illusion. And when people are in illusion, then they can do any crazy thing. Prabhupada told me when I left Prabhupada's party, it was in March of 1977, here in Mayapur. And just as I was leaving, I went in to, you know, offer my obeisances and get Prabhupada's blessings. And then he preached to me for about 10 minutes, and he said, "You should always remember the whole world is a madhouse." He said, "So when you go and preach to the patients in a madhouse, you try to help them." He said, "Just like the doctor goes. So sometimes the patients give him a slap, yeah, because they don't want the medicine. But he doesn't mind. He keeps on. He knows his business. He knows why he's there. And he administers the medicine because it's for their good." So he said, "Don't mind." He said, "You're going into a madhouse and you have to be prepared for that. But you have to go on with your work." He said, "But don't you yourself become mad." Yeah, by association. So that's the position of the preacher. You're taking a risk. Jesus took a risk. Muhammad took a risk. Yeah.
Just this interesting analogy with the madhouse which you brought up. In madhouse, if a person tells you, "I'm Napoleon," you can't convince him that he's not Napoleon. You're Napoleon, but you just take this pill, you know, like, you not always confront the mad people in order to administer them the medicine.
Yeah. Preaching is confrontational by nature, but the techniques that you use to deliver the message need not be necessarily confrontational. If you're very expert, just like Srila Prabhupada, you know, in like an eagle, out like a plow. Not that you come in with the plow all of a sudden. You go in like a needle and then come out like a plow. Prabhupada went in with the chanting, prasadam. He didn't say too much. He said, "That was my program right from the very beginning. I never said, oh, don't do this, don't do that, stop this, stop that. No, eat. Just eat and dance and go on." No philosophy. He said, in the beginning, no philosophy. Just chant, dance, eat, and go home. Then after a while, they become more favorable, and then they can hear. Then when you've got a person's ear, then you can start having some real dialogue with them. You can start educating them. By force, it's very, you can't force. You'll never force. What's that saying? A man whose mind is changed by...
A person who's convinced against his will remains of the same opinion still.
Yes, a person who's convinced against his will remains of the same opinion still. You'll never convince a person by force. But some people, in extreme circumstances, have to be removed. Like Duryodhana, yeah? You can't do anything with them. You can't do anything with them, and they cause a problem, so they have to be dealt with. But most people, you know, gradually they can appreciate.
It's deniable.
Yes, Bruno.
You can explain the difference with Srila Prabhupada and his spiritual master compared to Rupa Goswami, who rejected Jiva Goswami as the disciple because he defeated Maya. It's really this discussion.
The difference.
Yes, different mood.
Well, there was a different circumstance. The mood was the same, ultimately. The goal is the same, to spread Krishna consciousness and enlighten people. But Rupa, Jiva, Sanatan Goswamis, they were specifically sent to Vrindavan to revive the lost places of pilgrimage so that, you know, to bring people awareness of Krishna's presence again and to write the, you know, the teachings of Lord Chaitanya, to write them down and expand them so that people, you know, have some reference point and some literature and some guidance so that they can develop the Krishna consciousness. So that was the very beginning of Lord Chaitanya's movement. There was no literature. I mean, there was a Vedic literature, but the Bhakti Shastri, that needed to be expanded and revealed more and more. The principle of worshipping Radha and Krishna was not there before Lord Chaitanya. Maybe to a small, very small degree. But generally you see, like all the other, there was worship of Lakshmi Narayan, of course, but many temples, they just worship Krishna by himself. Radharani, the relationship of Radha and Krishna, you know, the whole revelation of Vrindavan pastimes, these things were not very well known. So their business was to lay the groundwork by revealing Vrindavan, the physical places, and also, you know, the literature that describes it. So that was their business. That's a little different from what Srila Bhaktisiddhanta and Srila Prabhupada were doing. You know, they were going out and actively preaching and challenging and setting up, you know, an institution to go
spreading
out.
Spreading to the West.
Hmm?
Spreading Krishna consciousness to the West.
Yes, yes. So each acharya, they have their own particular features and activities that they do according to the particular time, place and circumstance that they have to deal with. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta also, he was criticized by so many people, by his own brother, Lalit Prasad Thakur. He was very much against what Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was doing. When Bhaktisiddhanta was going around on his walking tours in Navadvip and in Vrindavan, the local people, the smarter Brahmins, they were throwing rocks at them. It got to the point where there was nearly a riot in Navadvip. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta was speaking and the smarter Brahmins hired some gundas to come and actually kill him. That was their intention. And because Sridhar Maharaj, Prabhupada's godbrother, looked in stature very similar to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, same kind of height and posture. So they dressed, he was a householder, they dressed him up as a sannyasi and he posed as Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, and Srila Bhaktisiddhanta was taken away, you know, through the back because of all these troublemakers. So that business is there. You know, you're always going to have opponents. But reasonable people, you know, they'll listen. They're the innocent. So mainly we concentrate on preaching to the innocent. But there are the demons also, and then, you know, we'd rather avoid them if we can. But if it comes to a point where you can't avoid them anymore, then you have to face the challenge. All right, let's go on a little bit. We've not covered this whole thing yet. Material world, okay, so there's this comparison here. And Atmaha, the killer of the soul. So, why is man given a better life than that of the swine and other animals? The answer is that a highly placed officer has to discharge duties of a higher nature. The duties of human beings that human beings have to perform are higher than those of the animals, who are always engaged in simply feeding their hungry stomachs. So this is in answer to the question that human being is given all facilities for a comfortable life. Why? And this is why. Because he has a higher duty to perform. Mm. You know, other living beings, their only business is just eating and sleeping, mating and defending. But human being, you have to go beyond that. And therefore there's a facility, there's provision for that. So, a polished animal in the form of a modern civilized man. Proper, so heavy sometimes. Yeah. Immediately, yeah. When we approach a polished animal in the form of modern civilized man, Prabhupada's having us distribute these books, there's your modern civilized man reading in Prabhupada's books that he's a polished animal. And I remember when we were in Madras, this was the 1st and 2nd of January in 1976, we did two programs in the evening at this big marriage hall, and about 2,000 people came each evening. So after the first evening's lecture, again, Prabhupada was, you know, he would preach very strongly, very strongly. So when we got back to the place we were staying, then Prabhupada called us in and he said, just bring the recorder. And he had us play back his lecture. And Prabhupada was sitting there listening to, you know, what he had said. And at one point he tells everybody that you're simply living like animals. You know, if this is all you're doing, eating and sleeping, mating and defending, you're just like animals. We shouldn't live like animals. And then Prabhupada was listening to that, he started laughing. And he said, just see, I have spoken so strongly. He said, I call them animals. He said, and still they accept, yes, we are animals. So he was kind of like expressing some surprise and innocence that they were accepting that, first of all, he was able to get away with calling them all animals, and secondly, that they even accepted it. Yeah? Because we knew that's because Prabhupada was able to speak the truth, but without that false egoism. Yeah? He wasn't on a thing that converting from one religion to another religion and seeing other people as enemies and his group as friends. Prabhupada was just disseminating knowledge for the benefit of everybody without any false ego to it at all. And therefore he could speak so strongly people would accept. Oh yes, we are animals. Swamiji says we're animals. Yes, look at what we're doing. Our lives are just like animals. So they accept that. Yeah.
I'm just thinking that preaching in India and preaching is the best, not Prabhupada could say it everywhere, but I see that preaching in India is still very much different than preaching in the West. In India you can say so many things because people are pious and somewhat God conscious, they can accept much more, even such strong things. In the West it would be very unsuccessful. I mean, if Prabhupada would say it, most probably it would be anyway successful. But in the West, somewhat different approach seems to be.
Yeah, at least in India, they're familiar with Vedic culture. There's a background, and so when you speak on the on the basis of the Veda, then people are immediately willing to listen to that. And most people are, by and large, you know, God conscious to some degree or another. They believe in God. In the West, either they're outright atheists, or if they're religionists, they're into some very dogmatic, you know, religious approach, and so it's very difficult. One of the first things that we learnt when we, you know, go out on Sankirtan was that you never talk to Christians. Right? When you're out selling books, the first thing that you learn when you're a bhakta is never talk to a Christian. Because all they want to do is to come and cause a disturbance. Take up your time and argue. But they're not interested actually in hearing, you know, logic and reason and nothing. They just want to come and put their dogma on top of you, that's all. So after a while, as soon as you can spot them coming along, here's a Christian, and avoid them. Yeah. But many people are, you know, just innocent. They're not so dogmatic. But in India, people are generally very pious. It's a fact. The problem in India is that they're all Mayavadis. That's a big problem. Okay, let's go on a little bit here. So, he will simply say that he wants to work to satisfy his stomach and that there is no need for self-realization for a hungry man. So we actually had an experience of this. There was a man that we met on a morning walk in Chandigarh in 1976. We'd gone there for a five-day fandang. And on his morning walk, Prabhupada went once more to the Rose Garden and again spent a substantial part of his outing sitting on the lawns. This is from the fifth volume of my diary. His presence in the city has been noted, and many gentlemen acknowledged him and paid their respects as they passed by on their daily exercise. Once again, a small group gathered around him on the grass, and Prabhupada gave another impromptu darshan, engaging in a sometimes lively debate about the purpose of human life. One fellow in particular expressed his opinion that beyond eating and sleeping and maintaining his family, there is nothing more. He had no time or interest for God. Srila Prabhupada presented a strong case for spiritual development, but although the man could not deny its validity, neither could he readily accept it. On the drive back to the house, Prabhupada expressed his regret that society in India has come to such a stage. But he is not surprised. People are turning their backs on their own culture to run after the West, and decades of secularism in government and education have significantly undermined the natural spiritual inclination of the Bharat Vasis. Vedic knowledge and outlook have been eroded and devalued to the point of inconsequence in the lives of the majority, especially in the cities. His divine grace's work is as keenly needed here as it is in the West. So he met this man. No, all we need is just some roti and cloth. That's all. He was saying that to Prabhupada. Prabhupada was surprised. This is in India. And so in the evening at the Pandal, he was speaking on 7.1 from the Gita. He brought this up. Prabhupada was very, you know, topical in his preaching. He'd hear something, you know, some disciple would send a letter and report on something, or on a morning walk, some disciple would say something that had happened in their experience. Or in Prabhupada's own preaching, he'd meet somebody and he'd hear something, and then he would immediately utilize that, you know, in his classes, or if he was doing pandals, or sometimes you see in his purports, he'll extract some practical incident and he'd put that, you know, some philosophical presentation on that particular incident. So he did the same here. One by one, he described the different types of demonic personalities. As he did so, he recalled the comments made to him on his walk this morning. Third one is Naradharma, one who by acting very sinfully becomes degraded, even with the human form of life. Today morning, I met a man. He said, "I want only roti, garments, and a home to stay, so I have nothing to do with God." All right, you want the roti and garment, but there are animals. They don't even want the garment, even only the roti. So the animals are better than you, because they only need a roti. Scripture says those who are working hard only for bread are to be considered on the level of the hog. We see the hogs are working very hard all day long in the search for stool. They always think, "Where can I find stool? Where can I find stool?" If a human being acts similarly by engaging himself in hard work just for bread, they are acting just like dogs and hogs. Everything is working like this. One who does not know God, who does not want to understand God, he is like a pig, animal. Sa eva gokara. This is the verdict of the scriptures. This is in a pandal for 5,000 people in there. Prabhupada speaking very strongly, very heavily. And people appreciate it. And similarly, then we'll go a little bit on here. Foolish people are suffering having forgotten God. They work very hard like a hog just to earn their bread with no higher understanding. So they think this is life. They don't understand this and they reject the scriptures. Just see, you've got a human form of life and you are working hard like a pig, like an ass. They pull rickshaw and they work so hard and have to go so far away, and still they are encouraged. Work hard, work hard. They do horses' work, asses' work, and still they are told, "Your hard work is not enough. Do more, do more." This is not human life. So, again, Prabhupada was hammering that quite a lot on that particular evening, talking about the pigs and dogs and donkeys like this. This is not human life. So he would speak very, very strongly. And there you see now in the purport, we'll go on. We are given this human form of life not to work hard like asses, swine and dogs. Human beings in this age have been forced to work hard like asses and bullocks that pull carts. That was Prabhupada's view of modern civilization. And in fact, during the period that I was with Prabhupada, India was under a state of emergency. Indira Gandhi, the ruler of Bangladesh, what was his name? Rayman. He had been assassinated. Actually, it was the day before Prabhupada met Indira Gandhi. This fellow was assassinated in Bangladesh. Prabhupada said he was hoping to have a very fruitful meeting with Indira Gandhi, present his ideas. And he said she was so nervous and on edge because of this assassination next door, practically, that she could hardly hear him. And so the whole meeting... But she afterwards commented that she thought that Prabhupada was a very saintly person, a very genuine saintly person. But anyway, that's the state that they were in. And so she declared a state of emergency. She had about 1,800 opposition politicians arrested and thrown in jail. And she had this state of emergency running for about 18 months. So that was throughout the end of 75 and 76 up until the beginning of 77. And they had big billboards. And on the billboards it was painted, "Work hard, don't talk, work hard," like this, all over every city. So Prabhupada used to see those billboards and he would comment on them, and one morning he did do in Vrindavan. Some devotees have recently informed Prabhupada of B.V. Tirtha Maharaj's condition in his last days. This is another thing about suffering, actually. I just added this, I thought it was interesting. This was Tirtha Maharaj from the Gaudiya Mat. He died during September 76. It seems he was taken from Mayapur to Calcutta Hospital, where he spent his last couple of weeks largely comatose. He was given injections and hooked up to all kinds of tubes and devices, which pumped fluids and medicines in and sucked the wastes out. Although Prabhupada didn't think very highly of Tirtha, he was sympathetic to the such suffering of his godbrother at the time of his death. He even mentioned it in his class this morning as an example of samsriti, the misery of material life. He told us, at the time of death, nobody knows what will happen. Recently one of our godbrothers has died. He was suffering that he, some glucose food, was being supplied through the nose, and then with what that is called. So that is also another suffering. Forcibly taking out the urine, cannot speak anything. So this is suffering. The only thing that can save us from this suffering, Prabhupada said, is to take shelter of Krishna. He detailed the whole business of samsriti in terms of pavarga and apavarga, the different stages of suffering in the material world. And he used India as an example. Now our leaders are advertising that work hard, work hard. Sir, I am working so hard, I am working like an ass, like an animal. I am tired. Still I have to work? Yes. This is samsriti. They are not satisfied that human being Indians are working just like ass, pulling tailor, rickshaw, and still they are requesting work hard. So this is called Vyartata. You work hard, hard, hard. Still you will not be successful. So pa, fa, ba, pa, and at last ma. Ma means mrityu, frustration and die. And again, begin with pa, birth. So this is going on. So this is called repeatedly, pa, fa, ba, pa, ma. So if you take to Krishna consciousness, then this pavarga will be counteracted, not otherwise. So that's a nice cross-reference there with the Bhagavatam, describing the hard work of material life. Everybody has to face that. And the only liberation from that is Krishna conscious, if you actually work in this Ishvashya principle. So let's just round up, we'll finish off this purport. In the Gita 6:41 to 43, it is stated that a man who enters upon the path of self-realization but does not complete the process, despite having sincerely tried to realize his relationship with God, is given a chance to appear in a family of Shuchi or Srimat. If even a fallen candidate is given a chance to take birth in a respectable and noble family, one can hardly imagine the status of one who has achieved success. Good example. Such materialistic asuras sometimes make a show of religion, but their ultimate aim is material prosperity. Bhagavad Gita rebukes such men by calling them atma-sambhavita. Means that they are considered great only on the strength of deception and are empowered by the votes of the ignorant and by their own wealth. Such asuras, devoid of self-realization and knowledge of Ishvashya, the Lord's universal proprietorship, are certain to enter into the darkest regions. And that, of course, Prabhupada mentions about particularly materialistic religions. There are many religions. Their whole basis of their religion is that you get material prosperity. Yeah? You worship God, you do these things, and then you'll get a nice wife, you get a nice home, you know, you'll be successful at your business. And this is the proof that God exists. Yeah? Material prosperity. And as soon as your material prosperity is finished, oh, no more God. That's the defect there. And he gave the example one time on a morning walk here in Mayapur, where about the, just like in Germany, actually the German troops all had a badge. They said, Gott mit uns. Yeah? God with us. God is with us. So in Germany, it's well known that after the war, so many men didn't come back all the families became atheists. They were all praying to God, please bring back my brother, please bring back my father, please bring back my husband. And then when they didn't come back, oh, no more God. God doesn't exist. Why? Because I didn't get what I want. So this is materialistic religion. I worship God for what I want. I want this, I want that. Of course, that's a little pious, it's better than nothing. But the danger is that when you don't get what you want, then you deny God. So therefore, Prabhupada said this is actually still in the darkest regions. This is not real religion. But the real religion is Ishvāsya, the Lord's universal proprietorship. The conclusion is that human beings, we are meant not simply for solving economic problems on a tottering platform, but for solving all the problems of material life into which we have been placed. So that's the end of the purport. I'll just, a couple of other things here that added notes about Atmaha, this soul killer. Here is a chance for you to become Krishna conscious and solve all the problems of life. If not, you go into the cycle of birth and death through 8,400,000 species. It will take many, many millions of years again to come back to the human form. Just like you will see the sunshine again in the morning after 12 hours or 24 hours. Everything is a process. A process. So if you lose this opportunity for elevating yourself, then again you come through the process. So a process means that if there's a law, there's a system. You can't avoid that. So if you don't do what you're supposed to do, then you again, you get put into another part of the process. Yeah? It's not that you just kind of disappear and there's nothing. No, there's a process. So if you don't successfully complete the human form of life, or at least begin it, then by process, you'll again go back into some other species and then you've got through the whole same old thing again. Puna punas chavita chavananam, chewing the jute. In the Shastra, it is called Atmaha, committing suicide. And then he quotes, of course, I think that's Narottam Das, yes. If we do not come to Krishna consciousness by getting this valuable human form of life, then certainly we are committing suicide. We are drinking poison knowingly. So that's modern civilization, suicidal civilization. We just talked about that earlier. So any questions or comments? Yes, Kim.
Many people on the planet are suffering just to get bread, and they're not doing it for purpose. Like they need like some food, otherwise they will die, and millions are dying because of that.
Yes.
So how to explain to these people if they do? I mean, maybe it's non-preaching fields, not so, but in South America, the world's secret one, Africa, it's maybe a problem. How to deal with them in a sensitive way?
Food for life. Okay. Hare Krishna, food for life. Yeah. Prabhupada started the ISKCON Food for Life, it used to be called. ISKCON Food Relief, actually, it was called originally. He started that after they first got the land here in Mayapur. And then Prabhupada, because the Bangladesh war was going on, and literally millions of people fled Bangladesh and came into India. It's only 25 miles away. The border is very close here. And so this whole area was filled with refugees. And we had our prasadam going on, and then little kids, Prabhupada saw, they were coming into the garbage and scraping all the leftovers off the leaf plates and everything just to get something to eat. And dogs, you know, the kids and the dogs were there together, aren't people? And Prabhupada saw that, and he actually cried. Because, you know, he's seeing here's the human beings, and they're reduced to this. Just for the sake of, you know, finding something. You have to keep body and soul together. It's not like we're against eating. You know, you have to eat. But you shouldn't spend your whole life just on that endeavor of eating, sleeping, resting, and defending. But if you can't eat, then you can't do anything. So that problem has to be solved at least to some degree. And therefore Prabhupada told the devotees, now you need, you feed them, let them eat. Give them Krishna prasadam. So that's dovetailing, that's altruism. That's a classic example of altruism, actually. Yeah, food relief. But prasadam, we don't give them any old food, we give them prasadam, because that will purify them as they're eating and solving that problem, but then they're also getting this spiritual beginning. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, he had his hand up first. I'm sorry, what's your name, Prabhu?
Divya Prabhanda Das.
Divya?
Prabhanda.
Prabhanda. Prabhanda. Okay. Hare Krishna.
So it's a kind of a, actually a commentary, not really a question, but I think maybe you can say a few words after that. When we are speaking about this Prabhupada using all these words directly, you know, how to say, judging people directly, smashing people and speaking strongly. So then there is, you know, we said there is an argument, somebody can say we are not on this level as a Prabhupada. But then when we will be on the level of Prabhupada? Never. If we are, you know, sincere, when we will never come to the level of Prabhupada. So that means we will never speak it as he showed the example. Another thing is that actually he was not speaking. He said, "I'm not speaking. Krishna is telling this." Because Naradama, as we saw, this Krishna is using these words. Naradama, Muda, Asura. Krishna is actually using these words. So I think there is no problem in speaking strictly if we have a sense that we are trained like that. We have to. This is just to actually, and not only in India, in West also. I have experience like that. If you speak strongly, you know, people, then they are challenged and they listen. Otherwise they are dull. They're just interested in sex and drugs and rock and roll, you know, young people. But if you tell them some heavy thing, you know, then immediately they'll be shocked and they will think about it. Wow, this is something different. I never come across such a person. Nobody tell me something like that. So then they will start to think. But that, of course, should be, you know, it should be,
yeah, expert. It's not, nobody's saying that you have to be like Prabhupada to be able to speak strongly. You just have to be expert, that's all. You have to develop a little expertise. If you go up to somebody and say, "Hey, you big animal, come over here." Nobody's going to take any notice of you. They'd probably come over and punch you or something. You know, but if you go up and say, "Excuse me, sir, would you like to be happy? Yeah. Are you experiencing full happiness in your life?" Yeah. And then you start preaching, then you start explaining, well, what is it that you're doing? Just actually, human beings, we're just eating and sleeping and mating and defending, but this is just the activities of the animals. But we're a bit more than the animals. So that way then, you know, if you're a little expert in preaching, then you can say strong things. And they'll accept it. It just depends how you present it. So that takes a little practice.
My point is that we should speak like, as we saw Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati was speaking like that, Prabhupada was speaking like that, so we should also be lions, not rabbits.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, definitely. Somebody else had a question?
Yeah. It's about food for life, because I understand in war in some country people really need to eat. But what about food for life in some country in the West? When they distribute food and you get only the really low class people and there is no preaching, there is no nothing. Only they're giving some food, they take it and they go. What about this?
Well, 2 points. Prabhupada said that prasadam distribution is for everybody. It's not poor feeding. Prabhupada wanted to make it very clear, prasadam distribution is not exclusively for feeding the poor. We are not poor feeding. We're distributing prasadam indiscriminately because everybody is poor spiritually. The rich man and the poor man, so-called, but none of them know anything. And so they all need prasadam. So we don't, it's, you know, the, to some degree our food relief operations have become gradually directed just to the so-called poor people. But that's actually not what Prabhupada intended with this food relief. Although it's a necessity and it should be done, but it's not limited to poor people. And then secondly, just the act of giving prasadam to somebody and them eating it is preaching. Don't underestimate the potency of that. Like you say, oh, we're just feeding them, they eat and they go away. That's fine. You should be very happy. They came and they ate prasadam and now they've gone away. That means already their bad karma, all their misfortune is going to be finished. And if the more regularly that they come and eat prasadam, then the more spiritually advanced they'll become. It may not manifest immediately. It may not manifest until their next lifetime. But because they've eaten prasadam, they're guaranteed in the future another human form. Guaranteed. Despite all the other things that they're doing, but if they've eaten prasadam, they'll get a human form in the future. That's guaranteed. So prasadam is a very, very powerful form of preaching. But it's agyata sukriti. For most people, it's agyata sukriti. It means that they don't actually understand the spiritual benefit of eating prasadam, but they still get the benefit. So that means in the future they'll become devotees. So that means the more you do prasadam distribution, the more potential devotees there'll be in the future. Yeah, maybe we won't see them in our lifetime, but in the future there'll be more and more people that will be receptive to Krishna consciousness, provided those souls take birth again on this planet, of course. But that may be likely also. So don't think that prasadam, you know, distribution is not preaching. Just that in itself, it is preaching. Any other comments, questions? Yes,
ma'am. I want to ask two things. First, please, in this regard, I want to ask, sometimes we are thinking, okay, the person is me, once he's taking prasadam, and then if we see he's just trying to take advantage from the devotees and so on, we are cutting them. Is this proper?
No, I think I mentioned this the other day. We are here to be taken advantage of. What does that mean, taking advantage? That means, oh, you're taking something from me and not giving something back. But everything is being supplied by Krishna. A devotee doesn't have that sense that, oh, I'm being taken advantage of. Everything is, Krishna is an unlimited supplier. As much as we can give out, Krishna will give more. That's the whole principle of the distribution of the love of Godhead. There's this storehouse, you know, that is unlimited. And even Lord Chaitanya can't give it out enough of it. He needs help. So we're giving out an unlimited commodity. And the more people take, the happier we should become. This mentality, oh, they're just coming taking advantage. Stop them. That's a materialistic mentality. That's not a preacher's mentality. Preacher means he exhausts everything he's got in the service of Krishna for the benefit of the conditioned souls. Second question.
The second thing was, I don't remember from where. I also heard the explanation that Mr. Mahan refers also to people who are killing animals. Because in this way they are stopping their evolution. Is it? Can we use?
It may be. I'm not. I've heard that somewhere a long time ago. It can be applied to the animal killers, particularly. I think Prabhupada does say that somewhere, that it can be particularly applied to those who are the killers of animals. But as he says here in this purport, anybody who's not using their human form of life for its intended purpose, which is the development of God realization, is an atmaha, a killer of the soul. But there's some people that are particularly, how we can say, killers of the soul, which is, I mentioned about the scientists, you know, the evolutionary scientists. They're particularly interested in killing the soul, denying the viability of the soul. So they're prime examples of atmana. But there may be others. And killers of animals, that's another good one, because it stops their own advancement as human beings, stops the advancement of the soul in that animal form also. Okay, last question.
The
sink in some sort about giving prasadam and being taken advantage of. Sometimes maybe this person who comes, he gets an offensive mentality. You know, it just fools, you know, they give food for free and come, just eat, you know, don't give any money, you know. Just start coming with this offensive mentality. So I'm just thinking, is it maybe more proper to stop him from committing offenses like this, or...
You have to see...
Little speculation.
How it balances out. When the balance, you know, goes on the more offensive side, then the spiritual benefit side, then check him. But if he's still getting more spiritual benefit, even if he's a little offensive, then let him still come. Yeah. It's...
Can I say a comment?
Well, it's just like Prabhupada said, you're going into a madhouse. You're not preaching to sane people. So some of them are a little more crazy than others, and they cause a disturbance. But that doesn't mean that you don't, you know, give them Krishna consciousness. The only thing that will cure their madness is by repeatedly having contact with the devotees. So a devotee never denies his association to anyone, unless the person becomes so offensive, you know, that it creates a disturbance in the preaching effort, then you have to stop them.
I can feel something, because you mentioned about this proposal, question about taking advantage of, about, you know, like, it's instigating principle and taking advantage, which is very interesting. There is one time, one reporter asked Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur that very question, because he started so many projects at one point, and the devotees were a bit in debt, and the project was building up. And then he says, how are you going to, you don't work, how are you going to supply money for this? And then he says, I'll just bring a brick from Vaikuntha, and that should cover the whole thing. And I should pray that you bring a brick from Vaikuntha, and that's what good for the whole thing.
Krishna is not a poor man. Prabhupada said many times. He can supply. And Prabhupada actually, there's a letter that Prabhupada wrote to all temple presidents. This was in mid-January of 1977. We were on the train from Allahabad to Calcutta. Rameshwara was the secretary. And the devotees had failed to have prasadam distribution at the Kumbh Mela, and Prabhupada was very angry about it and very upset that they weren't able to organize it. It was one of the main, going to be one of the main features, and they just blew it. They just didn't organize it properly, so it was a failure. So Prabhupada wrote a letter to all temple presidents ordering them, it wasn't a request, it was an order, that every temple must have at all times of the day enough prasadam to feed at least 10 men. So if 10 people walk in, you can immediately sit them down and feed them. Puri, halava, like this, some sabji. And then as they're being fed, then you immediately prepare some more, so that if more people come, then they can be fed. And if nobody comes, then you can distribute that prasadam at the end of the day to the devotees, so there's no loss. So he said, you cannot say, oh, it's not yet prepared, there's not enough, we have no money. He said, Srimati Radharani is personally managing all the temples. So he said, there's no question of any, you know, there not being enough. She is the goddess of fortune. She's the origin of all the goddesses of fortune. So she is personally managing the temples. So he said, if you say that there's not enough or we can't afford it, that means, he said, that you have no faith in Krishna. He actually says that in the letter. That means you have no faith in Krishna. Oh, these people are coming simply eating and taking everything and we can't supply. Then that stopped them from coming. That means you have no faith in Krishna. That's the point you're making. Now bring a brick from Vaikuntha, that'll pay for everything. Krishna can supply unlimitedly to his devotees. But you actually have the devotion. All right, we'll finish there. It's getting late. Tomorrow is Advaita Acharya's appearance day, so we have a day off. Half day fast and a feast. Oh, I don't know. I doubt whether there'll be a feast, actually. In Mayapur, they're not keen on making feasts on feast days for some reason or another. Because it costs too much. That's the excuse that they give. We can't afford it, so what can I say? Anyway.
Maybe the UK people can pay for one.
We recommence on Sunday. Yeah. So thank you very much. Shiva Karam Pani.